Sir, Reese nodded toward the Admiral. The Admiral continued to write something down without looking up at his guest. Reese glanced from the Admiral to Captain Howard, back to the Admiral, and then out the window. He was not offered a seat.
What the hell happened in Afghanistan, Commander?
The smaller man finally spat out. Sir, replied Reese.
You know, said the Admiral, finally looking up. You're tremendous fuck-up!
Reese shifted his gaze to the JAG, whose face remained unchanged.
Sir, I take full
You are damn right you'll take full responsibility. This is a huge black eye for our community. Those men are dead, and you tarnished the hard-earned reputation of this brand.
Brand? What the fuck is this guy talking about?
Sir, there is no one to blame here but me. I was the ground force commander. The responsibility lies with me.
We've already established that, Commander. What we haven't established is why.
Why? This obviously was not a condolence call about Reese's wife and daughter. What is this about?
Why?
That is a damn fine question. Why? It suddenly clicked. The Admiral wanted to test Reese to see if he was going to open up about the mission and tactics being pushed from higher. It had not been clear at the time exactly who higher was. Now Reese knew. Reese's eyes didn't leave the Admiral's, but they changed from merely serious to ice in less than a second. Reese thought he could see the Admiral visibly shrink back in his seat.
Sir, that mission came from higher authority,
Reese said slowly in a voice devoid of emotion.
No, it did not, Commander Reese. Do not shirk your responsibility. You were in charge and you failed. You failed your men and this nation.
The Admiral stood, finally hitting his stride.
NCIS will finish their investigation shortly. They will find you negligent, and I intend to see you court-martialed. In the meantime, I am ordering Captain Howard to pull your security clearance and start Trident removal procedures.
Reese stood stone-faced, looking straight through the fuming one star in front of him.
The list of charges against you is a long one, Commander, and I am going to ensure that when the military justice system is done with you, there will be absolutely nothing left.
Sweat began to bead up on the Admiral's forehead and upper lip, spit escaping as he almost shouted,
And while we are going down this path,
the Admiral continued, standing and moving to the side of his desk, the platform putting him more or less on the same plane as Reese.
You couldn't protect your men. You couldn't protect your family. And it is high time you paid a price, not just for your failures, but for the tarnished legacy your father left on the teams.
Reese's jab caught the Admiral off guard, his nose exploding in an eruption of blood as the bone and cartilage broke beneath Reese's left fist. Before the Admiral could react, Reese had already dropped his weight, pivoted his hips, and delivered a right cross to the already broken nose with such devastating power, Howard thought the Admiral might be dead on his feet. Reese practiced restraint, but one wouldn't know that from the left hook that caught the Admiral's jaw and dropped him to the ground with a heavy thud. Howard had never in all his life seen such a transformation as the one he had just witnessed. He watched in horror, his back pressed against the office wall, hoping it would envelop him and protect him from what appeared to be the very incarnation of pure rage. Reese took a step toward Howard and stopped.
Leave him, Reese.
This is what the enemy must feel like when these guys come hunting them,
Howard thought. The look in Reese's eyes left no doubt in Howard's mind that Reese would have no qualms about killing him and leaving him dead on the office floor. His eyes were cold, and the JAG could only think of one word. Death. Although it was warm and Howard was perspiring profusely, his body inadvertently shivered.
Add that to the list,
Reese hissed, moving to the door and closing it calmly behind him. Howard slumped to the floor in disbelief, thankful to have escaped Reese's wrath and unable to take his eyes off the body of the unmoving Admiral. Back in the land cruiser, Reese took a deep breath. It had taken all his discipline to look as natural as possible as he hurried down the war comms stairs turned in his visitor's badge, and made his way across the parking lot to his vehicle. What next? None of this was making any sense. No mention of the tumors.
Did they really not know?
Reese knew the Admiral was a spiteful politician, only concerned with his next rank. The articles in the Washington Post were a testament to that vindictiveness and the man's true character. The question was, how would someone with such a weak inner constitution react to being knocked out in his own office? Would he use the power of that position to throw the book at his subordinate commander, or would he be so embarrassed to such an affront to this authority that he would keep it quiet and try to attack indirectly? Reese assumed the latter, but he wanted to be ready for the former. Regardless, his security clearance would be gone as soon as Howard could pull himself together and get to a phone, which meant he would no longer have access to any naval special warfare facility. Reese glanced at his watch. It would take the Admiral and his guard dog Jag a little time to recover and come up with their game plan, or so Reese hoped. Reese put the cruiser in drive and headed for Team 7.
Chapter 18. Admiral Pilsner leaned forward in his chair, elbows on his desk, with one hand holding his head and the other pressing an ice pack to the right side of his face. With tissues stuffed into his nostrils and blood staining the front of what had been an immaculate uniform, he shut his eyes and tried to concentrate. The events of the past hour had left him shaken and humiliated. At least Howard was the only one to see it, he thought. Sitting in the comfortable leather chair in front of the Admiral's desk, Leonard Howard was anything but comfortable. Continually squirming and looking anywhere except directly at his defeated boss, the captain was relieved only by the fact that Reese had directed no physical violence toward him. Against his better judgment, he broke his silence.
Sir, it is over for Reese. Assaulting a flag-level officer is beyond the pale, even in this community. I will have him in shackles and up for court-martial by the end of the day. We will keel-haul him, sir. He will not get away with this. We will strip him of his rank, revoke his security clearance, remove his cherished trident, and have him before a judge within weeks. He will spend the next decade in Leavenworth breaking big rocks into small rocks. If it hadn't hurt to talk so much, Pilsner would have cut his jag off sooner. He knew his nose was broken, and was thankful his jaw had escaped the same fate. Both eyes had swollen and would soon blacken. He had instructed Howard to have his aide cancel all appointments for the remainder of the week. He would have to come up with a believable excuse for the broken nose and bruised face that would allow him to escape with some dignity.
"Captain Howard," Pilsner began in a nasally tone, unbecoming of his station, "we will do no such thing."
"But, sir, he assaulted you in your office in front of a witness. He needs to be brought up on charges immediately."
"Leonard, I am telling you no. Do you realize what will happen to my reputation if word gets out that I was beaten up by an O4?
The Admiral asked, referring to Reese's pay grade.
"Sir, we can't let him get away with this. Let me remind you, Leonard, that I am the Admiral, and you are the Captain. Remember that when we were in this building?"
"Yes, sir," Howard muttered, looking at the floor.
"We are going to document this, but we'll take no formal action. You know what happens if Reese is taken into custody. We have discussed this. It would make it harder to get to him. We have to stick to the plan. We are going to let him walk. I want you to fill out a witness statement that you'll keep to yourself until such time that we need to create a paper trail. I also want you to take photos of my face in case we need them later. This evidence will fit into a pattern of behavior displayed by Reese that will leave no doubt regarding his guilt. I have a permanent
solution for James Reese, and this fits right into it.
Chapter 19. SEAL Team 7, Coronado, California. Reese's troop high bay was a gigantic room fitted floor to ceiling with rows of racks to hold the enormous amount of gear it took to remain one of the world's leading special operations units. Today it was empty, as Reese knew it would be. Putting his code into the cipher lock, he turned the knob and stepped inside into complete darkness, the door shutting and locking behind him with an audible click. Not only was it the depository of all the troop gear, it was also the epicenter of all things to an operator in a SEAL team. The troop space was a clubhouse of sorts, though more exclusive than any fraternity on Earth. Gone were the confident voices that had once filled this room. Voices of men who were the best in their field. No one was there to shout a greeting, make a joke, or ask a question. No one was busily adjusting gear or packing for the next training trip. Empty. All that was left above the roar of crashing surf was the hum of the air conditioners that never seemed to work properly. Reese stood in silent respect, eyes closed, imagining it as it used to be, filled with life and the unique camaraderie that drew and kept so many warriors in the teams. The smell of dust and dirt accumulated from training venues across the country and combat deployments around the world were deposited back in this single space in Coronado, California. When mixed with the sweat and added humidity from being so close to the ocean, it gave off a distinctive odor that those who had prepared for war there would never forget. His reflection over, Reese reached over and flipped the light switch, immediately illuminating the bay in a fluorescent white glow. Boozer had supervised getting the troops' gear back to the high bay, and it was a mess. It took a few minutes for Reese to find his bags and a few more for him to separate them from the others, take inventory of it all, and then load them into his Land Cruiser outside. Before leaving, Reese opened a small lockbox mounted on the wall. It was filled with keys. Reese ran his fingers through the semi-organized keys hanging inside until he found the set marked Donnie and stashed them in his pocket. After one last look back at his troop space, he shut the door and headed for the armory.
"Hey, sir, how's it going? I mean, how are you?
It's okay, Carl," Reese said with a warm smile. "I'll be okay," though he didn't really believe that himself. "It's just that I didn't expect to see you this soon after, well, after, you know."
Carl was the SEAL Team 7 armorer, not a SEAL, but a gunner's mate senior chief from the fleet assigned to Naval Special Warfare. He had been on a deployment to Iraq with Reese a few years back when Reese was leading sniper teams into Ramadi at the height of the war.
"It's been rough, Carl, I won't lie. I'm a bit lost and confused right now. Just need to take some time and get a little perspective on things."
Carl was a religious man and looked up to the SEAL officer in front of him. In Ramadi, Carl had seen Reese off on more missions than he could remember. He also remembered the great respect Reese garnered from not only the men under his command, but the more senior officers in theater as well.
"Carl, I'm going out to Nyland for a couple of days. Need to be with the boys right now."
Nyland was the Navy SEAL playland just outside El Centro, California, up against the Chocolate Mountains. A place where platoons and troops could shoot and blow things up to their heart's content while training to go downrange.
"Nyland?" Carl questioned. "I mean, shouldn't you go to, anywhere else, you know? Because it's okay, Carl. I just want to get out with the guys and away from all this for a few days. Need to get behind a Mark 48 and throw a few rounds downrange."
Now he was speaking Carl's language.
"Understood, sir. And, sir, my wife and I are praying for you every night." "Thanks, Carl. That means a lot."
"I guess you want to take a couple of toys out there with you,"
Carl said, changing the tone of the conversation.
"Absolutely," Reese replied with a smile. "Can you grab me 2,000 rounds of 7.62 Link and a case of the 77 grain Black Hills while I get my weapons?"
No problem, sir.
Well, at least it didn't look like the Admiral had put an APB out on him yet. Reese approached a machine on the wall of the armory and inserted his Team 7 ID. This would be the real test. He punched in his personal code, pressed his thumb against a pad on the wall, and looked into an iris scanner. NSW Armory security procedures had come a long way over Reese's career. He could remember a time when there weren't any security measures in place other than a master lock on a cage full of weapons. The good old days, Reese thought. The machine beeped and blinked green, opening both the door to the armory and the internal door that housed all of Reese's troop weapons. Reese grabbed a wheeled dolly for moving heavy items and made his way down the hallway, passing the other troop weapons cages until he arrived at the one he was looking for. He still had his personal weapons from deployment that he had never turned in, but still wanted to upgrade his stash for what was coming. Be prepared. Reese gazed around the large cage, mentally taking inventory. Though it was called a cage, it was really a room-sized partition filled with instruments of death. Before Reese were rows and rows of rifles, pistols, shotguns, sniper weapon systems, extra NODs, AT-4s, law rockets, Mark 48 and Mark 46 machine guns, claymores, boxes of C4 blocks, and data sheet for breaching. It was a gun nut's wet dream. Reese finished taking stock and began loading the dolly with the tools of his trade. Chapter 20. Shady Canyon Estates, Orange County, California.
Mike? Mike? Mike!
Sorry, honey.
Mike Tedesco responded, dropping his cell phone and reaching for the pacifier on the counter, toward which his wife was not so subtly gesturing, then quickly looked back into his uneaten cereal bowl as if the answers to some unanswered question floated among the Cheerios. Jenna Tedesco looked at her husband and sighed. He had been more detached than usual over the preceding months. Maybe the back-and-forth trips to D.C. were getting to him? Maybe it was his almost daily commute up to L.A., though he never complained about it. She knew he lived in Orange County only because she had grown up there and loved it. Her friends were there, and her parents lived just 30 minutes away. Her mom and dad could look after their three children, so Janet could attend many of the never-ending stream of lavish political fundraisers and charity events that were Mike's domain. Mike was always thanked and toasted for being the piece of the puzzle that linked all the others. This made her immensely proud. Mike Tedesco was technically a business consultant, but everyone who knew him referred to him as a fixer. He was connected in some way to just about everyone who mattered in Southern California, from the studio executives to key political figures. His friends called him 1D, since he appeared to be one degree of separation from just about anyone you'd want to meet. Tedesco was one of those people who are good at everything. He was the guy you hated in school because he never had to study and would beat you at golf on his worst day. His good looks and Ivy League education, combined with his athletic talents, gained him great favor with both sexes, but he was a surprisingly devoted husband and father. From the outside looking in, he had the perfect life. A home on the golf course in Shady Canyon, Orange County's most exclusive private community, an incredible condo in Maui, and a mountainside ski retreat in Deer Valley. An always new Range Rover for his wife and Bentley for himself completed the Southern California twist on a Norman Rockwell painting. Unlike many of those with whom he associated, he would have been just as happy, if not happier, as a river guide or ski instructor. He just happened to be good with people, and the truth was, he sincerely liked helping them. His challenge was juggling all his competing demands and making it all work. He lived in a constant state of guilt, probably from the 2 years he had spent in Catholic school early in life. His conscience ate away at him every time he was called to a meeting in D.C. or was stuck in traffic on the way to and from L.A. It was time spent away from his beautiful wife and children. He wanted out of the fast-paced life to which they had become accustomed. Mike also had a plan. He had a dollar amount in mind, and when he hit that number, he would retire. He could spend time with his family and travel on their schedule, not someone else's. Strangely, he did not feel the need to continue to accumulate wealth and prestige like so many others in his circle of friends. Once he hit his number, he would fade away. 2 years ago, connecting the players in the business plan that Steve Horn had outlined seemed harmless enough, even commendable. Mike would get to build the team that would purchase, clinically test, and market a drug that would block the effects of PTSD before it even took hold. A neuropathway beta blocker that would revolutionize the medical treatment of future veterans, preventing the destruction caused by the psychological toll of war. A mental prehab for warriors. Mike had gone to enough military and veteran group fundraisers over the years to have seen and heard the stories of those whose lives were completely altered by what they had done in combat. And this was a way for him to contribute more than financially. Mike's involvement in the project was not purely altruistic. Success in this endeavor would put him well above his number and allow him an escape from the trappings of his current life. Fundraising and supporting these foundations was a way for Mike to atone for the guilt he felt for not joining the military himself. If he was honest, it was because he was ashamed. Those nuns in Catholic school had certainly done their work. He had left his job as a congressional aide and was working in the Manhattan financial sector on a beautiful Tuesday morning in September, when the first plane hit the World Trade Center. Rather than rush to help, Mike ran the other way. When others headed for recruiting stations in the wake of 9/11, Mike found refuge at the USC Marshall School of Business. It was there that he discovered his real talent lay not in the analytics nor the leadership of business, but rather in the art of relationships and the nurturing of those relationships until they could be monetized. One of his closest mentors was a former California congressman who had failed in his own bid for the presidency a decade ago when one of his many affairs hit the media. At the time, Tedesco thought that his best horse had fallen, but it looked as if he was about to get a second shot at the title. That same congressman's wife was the current Secretary of Defense and a shoe-in for the Democratic presidential nomination next time around. That he was a trusted confidant of one of the most powerful couples in Washington only bolstered his standing in both the financial and political communities. Mike was the bridge between big money and big power. Unfortunately, the outcome of this particular bridge-building project had gone horribly wrong, and the actions of his partners had chilled him to the depths of his soul. What started out as something that could both save lives and help Mike reach his number had turned into a nightmare. To Mike, it felt as if he had ordered the killing of the SEAL team himself, though he did not become aware of the connection of the project to the highly publicized ambush in Afghanistan until Admiral Pilsner and his JAG had briefed him yesterday, no doubt at the suggestion of Steve Horn. Perhaps Steve knew Mike was the weak link and had to be kept in line. Psychologically, having Mike read in by the SEAL Admiral with whom he had sat at many a Naval Special Warfare Foundation charity event carried more weight than hearing it from Steve himself. The message was clear. If SEALs were willing to kill other SEALs to keep this project alive, it must be for the greater good. But to walk out of Pilsner's office and actually see the face of one of the men Mike had a part in destroying was almost too much to take. There sat the true hero, a cancerous tumor growing in his brain, his troop and family dead, oblivious to the array of forces lining up to further dismantle his life and ultimately destroy him. Mike was the weakest of the group. He knew it, and he knew that if he showed any signs of that weakness, the others would not hesitate to feed him to the wolves. This wasn't checkers, nor was it chess. It was three-dimensional poker, and Mike was going to have to play it out while bluffing if he was going to finish the game. Wait, not finish the game, but survive the game. His goal now was to make it through this disaster with his life and the lives of his wife and children.
If he could just keep his head down, he could deliver both his family and reach his number. Then he would be done with Steve Horn and his ilk for good. He would atone for his sins in this life or the next. Of that he was certain. God would punish him. The burden of his involvement he would carry alone all the way to the grave and whichever way he was headed beyond it. Chapter 21. Balboa Naval Medical Center, San Diego, California. Dr. Paul Russell finished his regular shift at Balboa Naval Medical Center and waved his goodbyes to the floor staff. He contemplated stopping at the gym on the way home, but he'd been on his feet all day and just couldn't find the motivation. At 48, his lack of drive was catching up to him, and he could feel his belly tugging against his loose-fitting scrubs. He walked through the maze of corridors that left visitors perpetually lost and headed for the staff section of the parking garage. He put the key into the door of his aging Volvo station wagon and climbed inside. His black nylon briefcase, swag from a medical conference, sat on his lap as he reached for the door to swing it shut. As Dr. Russell slammed the door closed, an unseen hand grabbed a handful of his hair and slammed his head back into the head restraint. The muzzle of a handgun pressed tightly into his neck under his jaw, gagging him. "Look in the rearview mirror," the voice said from behind him. "Do you remember me?" Russell hesitated, and then glanced toward the mirror without trying to move his head. He immediately recognized the face of James Reese.
"Yes, I know who you are."
"Why did you tell me I was clear when you knew about the tumor?" Reese asked calmly.
"I don't know anything about a tumor,"
Russell stammered, trying to maintain some semblance of control and failing miserably.
"Your labs and scans aren't even back yet. All they told me was to clear you, no matter what was wrong with you. They were going to kill my family."
"Who are they?"
"It was a DOD security guy of some kind. I have his card in my bag. I'll gladly give it to you. Please don't hurt my kids."
"Reach slowly into the bag and get me the card. Anything but a card comes out of that fucking bag and you'll bleed out before they can get you into the ER. Reese shifted the muzzle of the Glock 19 slightly and pressed it firmly against Russell's carotid artery. Russell's hands shook as he rifled through the unorganized bag looking for the card.
"Here it is. I found it."
"Put it on the armrest to your right." Russell did as he was told. "What exactly did this guy tell you?"
"He knew everything. He knew I was having an affair with one of the nurses here at the hospital. He told me that he'd kill my wife and kids and make it look like I did it to get them out of the way so I could be with her. I don't even want to be with her,"
Russell said in desperation.
"He said that you'd be coming through here on the way back from overseas and that I was to clear you ASAP, no matter what your condition was. I haven't heard from him since."
Dr. Russell closed his eyes tight, wincing. Suddenly the hand released his hair, the back door clicked, and the gun was off his neck. He felt the weight of the Volvo shift and heard the rear door slam shut. He glanced at the armrest. The card was gone. He shifted his bag to the passenger seat and realized that his scrubs were soaking wet. He had pissed himself. He sat in the car for 20 minutes, trying to stop shaking before starting it up and speeding home to his wife and children. Reese was starving as he drove away from Balboa and realized that he hadn't had anything other than coffee in more than 24 hours. He headed for an old-school Italian sandwich shop that he'd been to a couple of times over the years. It was a family business and the kind of place with no surveillance cameras and no one asking questions. When he pulled into the vintage strip mall, he found the parking lot mostly empty. The grocery store that had anchored the building had long since moved to a newer location and left a series of independent businesses in its wake, each trying to take advantage of the relatively inexpensive rent. It was the pre-dinner lull, and Reese was the only customer in the small restaurant. He ordered a sandwich, no mayo, and a glass of ice water, paid cash, and sat at the table closest to the glass doors at the entrance in an attempt to get a Wi-Fi signal from a nearby business. He had run home after his meeting with Katie and grabbed an old iPhone out of his overseas gear. He'd bought it used in Korea during a training mission a few years earlier.
He turned it on and found a weak signal from the nail salon two doors down. With the VPN running, he pulled a business card out of his pocket. H. Joshua Holder, Special Agent, Defense Criminal Investigative Service. The card listed an address and phone number in Mission Viejo, California, as well as an email address. A cell number was handwritten in ballpoint pen on the back of the card, which he assumed was Holder's. DCIS? Reese had only ever heard of those guys in the context of procurement fraud and couldn't figure out why they were involved in this investigation. And why would this agent leave his card? Maybe because he was certain I was going to be killed in a home invasion. Reese put Holder's name into the search engine and got hits for a bunch of Facebook pages, none of which appeared to belong to a DCIS agent based in Southern California. He scrolled down until he found a LinkedIn page for Josh Holder, Department of Defense. Bingo. He took a screenshot of the page and opened up the Signal app, putting in his password. He pulled the napkin out of his shirt pocket and typed the list of characters that he'd given Katie into the search bar. Her account was up and running, so he added her as a friend and sent her a message. "It's your friend from Green Beans Coffee. This guy fits in somehow," he typed, referencing their initial meeting at Bagram for authentication before attaching the screenshot of Josh Holder's account. He deleted the search history, turned the phone off, and put it into his pocket as his sandwich arrived. 10 minutes later, his cruiser was pulling out of the parking lot, headed toward Coronado. Chapter 22 Bottlefish Restaurant, Brentwood, California. Bottlefish didn't technically open until 11:30 a.m., but a call from Horn's assistant to the owner made sure that a manager was there early to open the door in time for the 9 a.m. meeting. Horn was a majority investor in the new restaurant venture and wanted this meeting off-site from his Capstone offices. The Brentwood hotspot was open, clean, and inviting, in stark contrast to the topics slated for discussion. As the men arrived, each was led to a booth where a carafe of coffee was waiting. Row after row of wine bottles were arranged horizontally nearby behind a wall of glass, making Saul Agnon wish he'd had a few glasses beforehand. Josh Holder made him extremely uncomfortable. He wasn't particularly big or loud. It was his total lack of emotion that unnerved Saul. Holder had helped plan this entire operation as a proxy for the Hartleys, along with Marcus Boykin, who had represented Capstone's interest. Neither man seemed to place any value on human life, but there was a key difference between them. Holder had no problem doing his own killing. Mike Tedesco and Saul Agnon sat awkwardly together on the same side of the booth out of deference to the third participant in their meeting. Holder arrived last, his crisp white dress shirt open at the collar and his dark gray suit coat unbuttoned, looking far too sophisticated for a government employee. Once all were present, the manager retreated to his small office to allow them complete privacy. Holder nodded contemptuously at both men as he slid into his seat across from them. No one said a word as he made a long production of pouring himself a cup of coffee and slowly stirring in cream and artificial sweetener. He took a sip before finally looking across the table at Agnon and Tedesco.
"So, what's this about?"
"Mr. Horn wanted us to speak to you in person about James Reese."
"What about him? Your contacts fucked up the ambush overseas that was supposed to kill him, and then the stupid gangbangers you hired to hose down his house didn't even wait for him to get home. Now you want me to fix it. Is that right?"
"Well, you see, we were hoping..."
"We?"
Agnon looked around the empty room and leaned forward, lowering his voice.
"Mr. Horn was hoping that you could eliminate the target."
Holder shook his head, visibly disgusted.
"Are you guys that dumb? This guy survives the ambush in Afghanistan, I suicide the only other survivor, and then a random home invasion takes out his family. Don't you think it would be just a little bit suspicious if he suddenly turns up dead at this point? Can we give the cops and the press a little bit of credit?"
Agnon started to speak, but stopped himself, looking to Tedesco for backup. The taller man finally spoke. He too was intimidated by Holder, but his relationship with their common mentor gave him a measure of courage.
Josh, Horn spoke to J.D., and he offered to help. I followed up with him, and he has a solution for us.
Solution?
He offered us the use of a sleeper asset. He said that you would know what he meant.
J.D. told you that?
Holder's disposition softened at the mention of his rainmaker.
Yes. He said that it was the best way to take Reese out without raising suspicion. With all the publicity from the Afghanistan fiasco and then the home invasion, Horn thinks this particular sleeper agent won't arouse that kind of suspicion. There is a lot at stake here, Josh.
If that option is on the table, I agree that we should move forward with it. If J.D. has offered it up, I'll make it happen.
Holder took another sip of coffee before staring directly at Tedesco.
You holding up?
What do you mean?
I mean, this kind of thing isn't your deal. You gonna be able to keep your shit together, or do I need to keep an eye on you, too?
Me? I'm fine, Josh. Don't worry about me.
Just don't get weak on us, Tedesco. We need everyone on the bus. How's that pretty wife of yours doing?
She's fine. I'm good. Seriously.
Good. Now, if you'll excuse us, Mr. Agnan and I have a couple of things that we need to discuss.
Okay. Let me know what you need from me.
Tedesco rose from the booth and walked nervously toward the door, wondering what it was that they couldn't say in front of him. Coronado, California. Reese slept better that night than he had since before the last operation overseas. He awoke without an alarm at 6:45 a.m., splashed some cold water on his face, and looked in the mirror over the sink. 18 years of jumping out of planes and helicopters along with lifting weights and practicing combatives on the mats had taken a toll. He looked tired. Not quite 40, he was surprised his thick, dark hair still didn't show signs of gray, although he did notice specks of it beginning to take hold in the beard that was coming in. All in all, he felt very fortunate to have escaped the ravages of combat relatively unscathed when so many other service members had returned from theater broken in body, mind, and spirit. Reese shuffled stiffly into the kitchen and found the coffee pot empty. Lauren was an early riser and always had the coffee made. He knew that little reminders like this would dredge up the grief of her death for the rest of his life, and there was nothing that he could do about it. Nothing but kill everyone responsible. He skipped the coffee and put on his running gear. Each combat deployment as a SEAL was prefaced by a training period where team members physically and mentally prepared for the dangerous tasks that lay ahead. Small errors in combat can lead to men coming home in body bags. And skills such as shooting, demolitions, using communications equipment, and employing first aid are perishable. Reese knew he had a fight of a different kind ahead of him, and ensuring that his body and mind were ready for it was the first step in his own personal workup. Preparing for his early morning run, Reese went through a series of active stretches before looking down at the iPod shuffle in his hand. He hesitated for a second before hitting the play button and closing his eyes. It was Lauren's shuffle. He knew the music would take him right back to her. He wanted her to be with him, but he also knew that when it came time to do the business, he would not want the distraction. Right now, however, it would fuel him. Pressing play and clipping the device to his shirt sleeve, he was rewarded with "I Will Wait," one of Lauren's favorite songs by Mumford and Sons. He remembered listening to it with her, wrapped in a blanket on the lawn section at a late fall concert, sneaking sips of whiskey that Lauren had smuggled into the venue in her boot. When they first met in college, Reese couldn't stand Lauren's taste in folk rock. He much preferred a more hardcore sound, but she soon had him converted, and they enjoyed many a night to the sounds of harmonicas, drums, fiddles, and guitars from bands around the world, with a few songs by Hank, Waylon, Haggard, and Cash thrown in for good measure. With Lauren's playlist vibrating through his earbuds, he began a run that would take him on a 7-mile loop around the island. He took the first mile at a slow and
even pace, and then began intervals of 2 minutes each, running at a hard, almost sprinting, anaerobic pace, and then alternating to a normal jog. For the final mile of the run, he left the sidewalk for the white sand of the beach, the same sand that he'd run on during Bud's nearly 2 decades earlier. His legs screamed as he fought to propel his body forward in the soft sand, pushing the pace as hard as he could. He sprinted across his self-imposed finish line at the rear of the famed Hotel Del Coronado, joining the line of vacationers coming in from carefree walks on the beach, heading toward the cluster of structures said to have inspired the Emerald City in L. Frank Baum's classic, The Wizard of Oz. Being a sweaty guy in workout clothes made you virtually invisible in most parts of the United States, especially hotels. He made his way to the 19th century lobby and accessed the free Wi-Fi. There was a message from Katie waiting for him.
"I found some stuff that you need to see. When can we meet?"
Rhys responded. "I don't have a job anymore, so I'm good whenever. Tell me where you'll be." Rhys stood for a second, staring at the screen and hoping that she was logged in and would respond immediately. She did.
"I have a rehearsal dinner tonight for a college friend who's getting married. I'll be staying at the Hyatt on Huntington Beach. Can you be there between 4 and 6?
"I can. I'll find you," Rhys typed, turning off the device and descending the steps at the front entrance of the hotel to grab breakfast on his walk home. Chapter 23. Huntington Beach, California. Rhys wheeled the cruiser into a spot on the beach parking lot and made his way across the pedestrian bridge to the Hyatt. He was dressed in khaki pants, an Oxford blue button-down shirt, and a blue blazer. He would pass equally well as a salesman or a guy headed to a rehearsal dinner, urban camo at its finest. He walked past a lawn area where party planners were putting the final touches on what he assumed would be the event Katie was attending. Judging by the elaborate setup and decorations, he was fairly sure the groom's father wasn't operating on a Navy salary. He wanted to avoid the lobby, if at all possible, but assumed that all of the beach-facing doors required room keys to access. He was right. He pulled out his phone and held it up to his ear as if in conversation. When he saw a sunburned, vacationing couple about his age walking in from a day spent drinking by the pool, he said, "Okay, bye," to his imaginary caller, and followed through the doors behind them. He walked down the main hallway toward the elevators and found a house phone on a small table. He picked up the handset and immediately heard ringing.
"Guest services, how may I help you?"
"Can you connect me to Miss Buranek, please? B-U-R-A-N-E-K.
"One moment, please." "Hello?"
"Katie, it's me. I'm here. What room are you in?"
2231. Second floor, east side of the building. Great view of nothing."
"See you in a minute." Rhys walked past the elevators and took the stairs to the second floor. He wandered the halls in a direction that he assumed to be east until he saw a sign directing him to the numerical collection of rooms that included hers, and knocked on the door. It opened immediately, and his jaw nearly hit the floor. Katie was obviously dressed for the rehearsal dinner. She was wearing a tight-fitting black cocktail dress that showed off her slim, toned physique. Her hair was down, and she glowed with just the right amount of makeup. She wasn't wearing shoes, making her almost a full foot shorter than Rhys.
"Geez, how tall are you, 6'2"?
She asked, popping up onto her tiptoes for effect. People always thought Rhys was taller than he actually was. She surprised Rhys by giving him a big hug, and he stiffened up uncomfortably. Unsure of how to respond, he patted her on the back as if he were hugging his grandmother. "God, she smells good," he thought, with more than a little guilt.
"I'm sorry, I'm a hugger,"
Katie said, as Rhys stood speechless. She looked him up and down.
"You clean up well? Come sit down. I have a ton of stuff I want to show you."
She pulled a manila folder out of what looked like a beach bag and spread a series of photos on a small table near the room's balcony. She sat down in one of the chairs and Rhys took the other. The photos were printed on regular printer paper, so the resolution wasn't great, but they were still decipherable.
"I pulled all of this stuff up using the database at Fox. I freelance for them so they give me office space when I need it and access to their systems for research. They have an extremely sophisticated database and the ability to search using facial recognition technology.
I don't have my own username or anything, so it would take some work to figure out that I'm the one who pulled it up.
She held up the first photo, which was an enlarged version of the headshot from the DCIS agent's LinkedIn profile. The man depicted in the photo was likely in his early 40s, fit with a hairstyle that made him look more like a TV anchorman than a federal agent.
This, as you know, is Josh Holder. He apparently was an Army CID investigator before hiring on with DOD. DCIS agents do a lot of contract fraud cases, but their powers are fairly broad. From what I can determine, he's from Northern Virginia and moved out here relatively recently.
As she pulled out the next photo, Reese couldn't contain his shock. It was one of those file photos that are taken by pool photographers outside of congressional hearings. It depicted the Secretary of Defense walking through the Longworth House office building, surrounded by what looked like a rugby scrum of aides. Walking closest to the secretary was none other than Josh Holder.
"What's he doing with the SecDef?" Reese asked.
That's a really good question. What is a mid-level DOD law enforcement agent doing walking alongside the Secretary of Defense and likely next President Lorraine Hartley? Best as I can tell, he's never been employed in a security capacity and nothing lists him as being part of her staff.
The third photo that Katie produced was a screenshot from a society magazine in L.A. and showed a tuxedo-clad Holder standing among a group of partygoers at a swanky charity event.
"Who is this guy?" Reese wondered aloud.
According to the magazine, that is Saul Agnon. I ran a search on him, and he's an employee of this man,
Katie said, pointing to a tall man in the center of the photo.
Steve Horn, big in finance. He runs Capstone Capital, which is a private equity fund. They do a lot of international work. The other guy in the photo is Mike Tedesco, Capstone-affiliated and a well-known fundraiser for the Hartleys.
That Mike guy was leaving the Admiral's office the day I was called on the carpet.
Well, that is not a coincidence. Somehow these guys are all connected, James, and I'm betting that whatever they're up to involves a lot of money and a lot of important people. I couldn't find out much more. Other than LinkedIn, Holder does very little on social media, and public record searches didn't turn up much of any substance. The only way I even found these photos was using facial recognition software.
I can't thank you enough for this, Katie. It gives me something to go on. I really appreciate your help. Go enjoy your party.
Happy to help, and I'm not going to ask what you're going to do with this information because I'm pretty sure I don't want to know. Just be careful.
Will do. Can I have these?
Reese asked, pointing to the photos.
They're yours.
Katie tucked them back into the folder and handed it to Reese.
Got an appointment for tomorrow to get my head checked out. I'll let you know how it goes.
He extended his hand, and she slapped it out of the way, coming in close for a hug.
I told you I'm a hugger.
Chapter 24 Head and Spine Associates, La Jolla, California. Reese was supposed to be at the clinic to get prepped at 6:30 a.m., but he couldn't sleep, so getting up in time for the appointment was not challenging in the least. He wouldn't have admitted it, but he was more than a little nervous about the biopsy. Not only did he know they were going to stick something into his brain, but the results could confirm that he was, in fact, dying. Added on to the events of the past weeks, it was all a bit overwhelming, but also freeing in a strange sense. The next world was calling, the one with his wife and daughter. He was certain he did not want to die in bed after an excruciating battle with a brain tumor. Knowing his death was imminent and assured made what he had to do all the more clear. There was nothing holding him back. In fact, death propelled him forward. He would die, avenging his troop and his family. It would be a good death, a warrior's death. The staff of the clinic could not have treated Reese any better or gone any further to put him at ease. The recent publicity of SEALs and their daring missions had given the public a glimpse into what guys like Reese had been doing for decades.
People went out of their way to be helpful when they found out what Reese did for a living, and while he appreciated all of it, he found the attention somewhat uncomfortable. He didn't feel that the American public owed him anything in return for his service. He felt lucky to have had a job that he loved for so many years, working among some of the finest soldiers in the world. The clinic was an architectural marvel, concrete and glass with wood accents that made it appear warm and natural. Designed and purpose-built as a world-class spine and neurosurgery clinic, it clearly catered to those with concierge medical service plans. There was no waiting and no other patients in the building, as far as Reese could tell. It was quite simply the best care that money could buy. After filling out some paperwork and answering a battery of questions asked by one of the nurses, he was taken into a room where they performed a CT scan with a device attached to his head. He was then led to an examination room where, after less than 10 minutes of waiting, a balding man in his late 60s entered the room.
"Commander Reese, I am Dr. German. Thank you for coming."
Despite the name, the man's accent and heritage were clearly Latin American. Reese stood to shake the man's hand.
"Thank you for seeing me, sir. I really appreciate it. Your staff has been wonderful."
"It is nothing, Commander. Let me tell you what we are going to do today,"
he continued, getting down to business.
"We are going to take a biopsy of the mass in your brain to see what it is. The procedure we will use is called a stereotactic biopsy. We have the exact location of the intracranial lesion from the CT scan. We actually use coordinates probably similar to the way you do when navigating. The computer gives us a map and tells us where to enter the skull. We will set up what's called a stereotactic frame on your head, which will guide the needle to the right spot. We are going to shave a very small portion of your scalp and give you a local. You will be awake for the entire procedure."
Reese's eyes widened even though he had been briefed and had researched the procedure ahead of time.
"I know this probably sounds scary, Commander, but it is very routine. You have faced far worse in your career, I am sure. I will make a very small incision, and we will use a drill to enter the skull. Again, I do not want you to be concerned, but I want you to know what we are up to back there when we are working. We will insert the needle into your cranium at that point and take a few samples from different areas of the lesion so that they can be analyzed by the lab.
Then I will sew you up, and you can rest here for as long as you'd like. When you feel up to it, you can go home. There is no need to stay overnight so long as everything goes as planned, and I am here to see that everything goes as planned. Do you have any questions for me, Commander?"
"Yes, sir. Well, you see a bunch of these, I assume."
"Yes, Commander, every day."
"Does this one look bad? From the scan, I mean?"
"I am just the mechanic, Commander Reese. My job is to go in and grab some tissue. I wouldn't know a good spot from a bad one."
"Any other questions?"
Yes, one more. How long would I have to live if this biopsy comes back as cancerous?"
"That is hard to say, Commander. There are too many factors to weigh and consider. If that is the case, we will ensure you have the best in the field, evaluate the results, and discuss options and outlook. I know that is not a very concrete answer, and for that I apologize. Let us not concern ourselves with that now. Let's first find out what we are dealing with. Then we will plan the way ahead. Sound good?"
"Yes, sir. Let's do it. Again, try not to worry. I promise we'll put everything back where it belongs.
My staff will get you ready, and I will see you shortly."
"Thanks, Doc. You are most welcome.
Thank you for your service to this country."
Reese asked his questions not because he was worried about dying, but because he was worried he might die before he could figure out why his troop and family had been killed and before he could deal with those responsible. The procedure wasn't really painful. It was an odd feeling knowing that someone was cutting a hole in your brain. Hearing the drill was the most unnerving part. Reese rested at the clinic for a couple of hours under observation of the medical staff before being discharged.
They sent him home with a couple of prescriptions that he filled on his way back to Coronado. It felt strange to be driving after just having his skull drilled open, but there really wasn't anyone to call for a ride. He took the prescriptions as directed and climbed gently into bed, spending the rest of the afternoon and evening sleeping intermittently and thinking about his next move. Chapter 25. Naval Amphibious Base, Coronado, California. Admiral Pilsner stood in the front yard of his taxpayer-funded home on Naval Amphibious Base, Coronado, overlooking San Diego Bay. The waterfront house on Rendova Circle was huge, even by flag-level standards, and blocked the views and bay access of the lower-ranking captains and one or two commanders lucky enough to have filled an empty housing slot. On-base housing was often filled with the type of officers who thought living in proximity to their bosses might help them with advancement. This created an environment fraught with envy and jealousy for their wives, some of whom wielded their husbands' ranks with a toxic disregard for basic decencies, with no official rules and for which few spouses were prepared. No one placed as much emphasis on their husband's rank as Mrs. Admiral Pilsner. She ran the Wives Club in much the same way her husband ran Warcom, making her even less popular with the SEAL wives than her husband was among his men. They had met on Admiral Pilsner's first deployment to the Philippines. He had never had much luck with women back home. His status as a SEAL officer got him many first dates, but his inflated sense of self ensured that things rarely progressed further. When Lieutenant Junior Grade Pilsner met a friendly local Filipino girl who gave him the time of day, he decided she was the one. For her part, the future Mrs. Pilsner saw the American officer as her family's meal ticket. Steady income in a poor nation with few opportunities, and she wasn't about to let this catch get away. Within a few months, Larissa Katakutan became Larissa Pilsner and was eventually granted U.S. citizenship. Assimilation was not a problem for the new bride. She took charge of her husband's bank account and became adept at maxing out his credit cards. Though it caused the admiral great financial stress, he felt compelled to provide her with a steady stream of new black Mercedeses, her car of choice. Mrs. Pilsner loved nothing more than to park it in the flag officer reserved parking at the base commissary or PX, flaunting her jewelry and, by extension, her status to the primarily Filipino grocery baggers. The couple had never had children, not because they couldn't, but because they were both too selfish to give what is required in parenthood. Today, even the admiral needed a break from her incessant talking, nagging, and gossiping. As she Skyped away with a relative back in the Philippines, Admiral Pilsner took his leave and made his way out to the front yard to make a call on a cell phone he used for only one contact. His first call went to a full voicemail box, which Admiral Pilsner knew was kept full by design. His second call to the same contact went to his assistant.
Capstone Capital, Steve Horn's office. This is Kelsey.
It's Gerald Pilsner for Steve Horn.
One moment, please. Let me see if he is available.
2 minutes later, Horn picked up the line.
Gerald, how's the nose?
How the hell did he know about that?
It's fine, Steve. It was all part of my plan to build support for the story that Commander Reese is unstable and capable of anything.
He lied.
Well done, Admiral. We appreciate your sacrifice. How did Tedesco take the news in your office?
He didn't look great. I think he's having trouble with this. We always knew he would be the weak one. He's great as a fundraiser, but gets wobbly in the knees when things get tough. We needed him for the Hartley connection. Keep him cool until this blows over. What's the latest on your man, Reese?
This is an unsecure line, Horn. You worried about them monitoring your calls? You're king of the SEALs, for God's sakes.
They monitor everyone's calls, Horn. Everyone's.
Okay. Let's just say that a plan is in motion, Admiral. Our problem will be solved in a week.
Our friend who is in town from Virginia is setting it up now. Wish I could tell you more, need to know and all that. And don't worry. The drama with his wife and daughter play right into it. All loose ends tied up, so